This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, we are in The Think Tank. Mike O'Neill here, flying solo without Mike Russell. We have, as promised for you this week, what I have billed as the most erudite discussion of charter schools that you will ever hear. Our guest, Lisa Graham Keegan, former superintendent of public instruction for the state of Arizona, former legislator, former many other things, and Julie Erfley, blogger, journalist, and again, also many other things. Let's start with Lisa. Context, just in case somebody's been living on another planet or they hear the word, but they may not know exactly what that means. We know what a conventional public school is. Mm-hmm. There are these other things called charter schools. First of all, what are they?
So, Mike, there's three kinds of public schools. Public district schools, which is a traditional school. Public magnet schools, which came out of the civil rights movement in the 60s. We still have a lot of those around. And public charter schools. Public charter schools were created in Arizona in 1994. And the purpose was to make sure we could make it possible for people who wanted to start schools, educators, who wanted to start schools and bring them sort of into the school market, that they would be able to do that outside of a lot of the constraints that we had created over the years in the district system. And the thinking was that in exchange for liberty to do that, you would have a higher performance level. The purpose for public charter schools is to increase academic performance in the larger sector.
Okay, let's focus on just on that, because you said less regulations, less rules. What kinds of rules specifically are charters exempted from?
So, for example, the law in Arizona now is very clear that no public school has to engage in a contract, sort of a formal contractual relationship between a teachers association and the governing board. That's not necessary in Arizona. However, traditional practice in school districts has been, you've got one really big sort of contract that deals with how you hire teachers, how you fire teachers, how you control teachers in the classroom, who you get to have in the classroom, et cetera. Charter schools don't have that as part of their operating procedure.
And you're saying
for the
most
part.
Arizona public schools do?
Most district schools, Mike. And so just for vernacular, they're both public.
Okay.
Public schools all have to take whoever comes. They have to produce academic material, et cetera. And the laws are the same for how you expel students, et cetera. So on the district side, still most of our traditional school districts are operating with that kind of a contractual arrangement. And the money for the school goes into, on the district side, it's generally going into the district office. And then there are decisions made about what services schools will get. But the school itself is not in control of its budget. At the charter level, if it's just a single charter, you still have that money going to the charter. Now you have a lot of large networks where you do have the money more and more kind of going through a central office and being distributed down into the charters.
That's a district school that has multiple charters.
Well, that would be not a no. In Arizona, we charter our schools mostly from the state board. School districts are not chartering. So in a school district, let's use Glendale Union High School District, a fabulous district. So that district is getting money and it's distributing it out to its schools in a really, really successful way. In, let's use the Great Hearts, for example, network of schools, they are getting money at the school level. That's how that works. The money comes up through the schools and then they distribute. They might make some payments out upwards. Just it's a matter of where the arrow's down or arrow's up. And the difference there that's important, Mike, is that the intention was that we put the majority of money in the classroom behind teachers. That's still a huge problem in Arizona. We still have to be doing it much better. I don't think we've figured it out yet, and we do need more money generally. But that was the purpose, was to try to say we need these liberties.
So far, I'm hearing two differences. One is that decisions are made more at the school level, and two, there are no basically contracts with what you've danced around the word, but basically union contracts.
Yeah, I didn't. I think I said union. I'm okay. Happy not to dance around that.
Okay.
The other big difference is a charter school creates a model for what they're going to be. So they create a model. This is how we will work. This is what we will produce. They make a promise, a charter. Then they go to a board and say, that's what we're going to do. District schools, traditionally, we have said we need a school because we have more student bodies. And you build that school and maybe it becomes some model, hopefully, but maybe it doesn't. So the importance here, I think what they can, there's a lot of things to learn from each other at this point. And the work that I do is actually with both. The most important thing, Mike, is that we focus on excellence. I think this conversation that we're having, frankly, sort of charters versus everybody else, it's informative and it's important. I don't think it's the conversation that needs to go on in Arizona. The conversation needs to be between what's excellent and what isn't. And in Arizona, we work at A for Arizona, where I work. We work with low-income A schools. 60% of those are district schools. 40% of them are charter schools. And I think a lot of people don't even know they exist. But these are schools serving a vast majority of poverty
now,
kids.
Now, I understood. Tell me if I have this wrong, but I understood that there are private charters and public charters.
That is a weird thing. There are no such thing. They're all public. No such thing as a private charter school.
Well, aren't there charter school operators who operate their own schools or free to contract outside, for example?
The laws are the same for every public charter school. Mm-hmm. There isn't such a thing as a private charter school, Mike.
There's only one kind.
There's only one kind. Public charter schools. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. There are private schools, but they are a different issue.
I'd understood also, I'm trying to explore what the differences are, and we're getting near the end of the first. I'd like, my goal of this segment is that we understand what the differences are. Charter schools are exempt from having to hire certified teachers. Am I correct?
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And as you know, there is no evidence that certification leads to quality.
I'm not implying that there is. I'm just trying to be descriptive here.
That's true. And that is complete liberty, right, in who you hire.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Are there any other differences?
Oh, I think a ton of differences. The most important one is that charter schools don't have a prescribed area, a geographic boundary that is required, you know, from which they're drawing students. Interestingly, though, Mike, in Arizona, less than 50% of parents now are actually agreeing to simply go to the school in their attendance area. We have massive shift now that is underway in district schools as well. So it's important, though, in order for a charter school to have kids in the school, they have to do that by choice. They have to go market themselves.
I've heard 85%. Now that's interesting because I've heard the figure 85%.
85% of students are in public district schools. Not necessarily the one in their neighborhood.
Okay,
we've
so
had open enrollment
they're still
since
in
the
public,
70s.
Traditional public schools, they've just crossed their boundaries.
Right, and that number is, right, that's the difference between where we were and where we are now after 20 years.
Okay. Lisa, Graham Keegan, former superintendent of public instruction. When we return, we'll hear from Julie Earfley, who has a kid in a private school in a charter school and wrote a fascinating blog about that. We'll be back in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are discussing charter schools. Julie Earfley, journalist, blogger, wrote a fascinating piece dissecting charter schools, one of which you have your kid in. Would you summarize?
Certainly. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me. I wrote this article mainly because of what Lisa was talking about as far as how we define what are our highly successful schools. And we've heard a lot of talk about these highly successful charter schools and about the need to fund the wait lists at these charter schools. And I find that very intriguing because my oldest son attends a basis school, which of course is always held up as sort of the model for these highly performing charter schools. And it is a wonderful school. I chose the school for a reason, and it does fantastic work. It is not a school that serves the typical Arizona student. And I think that that's the important part of the discussion. And that's when it comes to defining what is an excellent school, how are we defining that? Is it based upon the inputs or solely the outputs? And is the only output that we're going to measure test scores? And if that's the case, then we do need to focus on who are the students that we're putting into those schools. So let me give you an example from the basis model, since this is what I have experience with and this is what the article was on. So my oldest son attends this basis school. It's held up as one of the top schools in the country. It's excellent. They produce excellent test scores. This is a school that is for highly gifted, highly motivated, economically stable families.
That's who's coming in the first place.
And that's who's staying. More specifically, that's who's staying. So what you have is you have huge wait lists in schools like Basis in fifth and sixth grade because what parent doesn't want their child at the school that's considered one of the top schools in the nation? Of course you do.
In fact, I've even commented to people, one of the greatest marketing hooks that any private school uses is to label it as a school for the gifted.
Right.
Then all the parents, even if the kids aren't gifted, want to get their kids in it, figuring they'll be pulled up.
Exactly. And there's a reason that we have differentiated learning. I think differentiated learning is very important. And what you get at BASIS is you get students who are pushed 2 and 3 years ahead. Now, that's not work that just any typical student can do. They do have to be highly motivated. They do have to want this. They do have to have some ability to work at that pace. So, for instance, my eighth grader is doing AP World History. He's in his third year of physics, his third year of chemistry, his third year of biology. He's in advanced English. He's in a foreign language. He's in Algebra 2. This is just the eighth grade curriculum. This isn't a special curriculum for him. That's not a curriculum that just any typical Arizona child can do. It takes a lot to get there. And so what you find is you have students who they also take, let me backtrack just a second. At the end of the year, they take finals. And if you don't pass those finals, you don't pass the grade. Not just that class, you don't pass the grade. And so many students, when faced with the possibility of being held back a year or just going to a different school, will go to a different school. And it's why you'll see hundreds and hundreds of kids in the lower grades, but then by the time you get to high school, it quickly diminishes to several dozen students, and you have schools that are graduating many times less than 30 students.
I think your article cited that they're graduating about one in four is sticking it out.
I'm not even sure if that's accurate, because if you look at, so for instance, if you look at BASIS Scottsdale, they, you know, in the recent U.S. News and World Report, and they were listed as number two, and they listed 701 total students in 5th through 12th grade, but only 150 of those are in high school, and they had 20 students in their senior class. So there's a huge drop off.
After you start out with an elite population.
Right. Well, a lot of those students coming in, I think what they find is that it's just not a school for them, right? They're not, they may not want to do 4 to 5 hours of homework a night. You know, this may not be a school where they feel comfortable in this environment. This may be a school where they're struggling a lot and they'd rather be in a school that meets their needs better. It's a public school. It is a public school. So any child can apply. Any parent can apply. And it's not pitched as a school for gifted children. I think what you find out when you're in there for a short amount of time, that they are doing the same type of work that a lot of gifted classrooms in the district schools are doing. And so when you get to a class of, for instance, 20 students that graduate, and they've taken every AP course available, every advanced class you can possibly imagine, you're going to have students that score sky high on standardized tests. And if that's our measure of what a successful school is, I don't think that that's a true measurement of what a school is doing for students.
So my takeaway is start with a highly motivated, highly performing group of kids. Screen out the ones who aren't willing to work 4 or 5 hours a night or otherwise decide it's not for them, and you're going to have sky high scores.
Right. Right. And so and that goes to the larger point of how are we measuring what is a successful school? If test scores are the measurement of a successful school, then you can easily skew your curriculum so that that's who you're getting, are students who can perform really well. So we need to look deeper than that. And the other point that I made in the article, and that was incredibly important to me, is that we do have this huge achievement gap in our schools. And we keep focusing, I think, on the schools that are producing great test scores and wanting to duplicate them without looking at the inputs first.
Well,
and without understanding, the other thing that I think we need to understand is that sometimes it's not all about what's happening in the classroom. It's what happens outside of the classroom. It's about some of the services that are required outside the classroom to make in the classroom successful.
Well,
so reading specialists, tutors, free and reduced lunch, guidance counselors,
speech therapists.
Those are important factors of a child's education and getting them to where they need to come. Because the other thing that we never talk about in this state, or hardly ever talk about, we definitely don't hear from our capital, is that we have some of the highest rates of childhood poverty in the nation. Okay, so our students are coming into our schools with a lot of disadvantages, with a lot of problems. They need wraparound services.
Let me respond to that one, okay, or ask a question about that one. Okay, we've got higher rates of child poverty. a lot of the critics of that sort of scheme say, you know, doesn't that end up being an excuse sometimes?
No, I don't think it ends up being an excuse. These kids are not less capable. Mm-hmm. Not at all. I think it's just a matter of they need some of these wraparound services that are important as well, because they don't have the type of stability that other kids have. They may not have the support at home when it comes to homework. They may not have the ability to come to school with a full stomach. Those things do matter when you're in the classroom. And I think if you talk to classroom teachers, they'll talk about how that matters. I mean, I also have a younger son who's dyslexic. A reading specialist is crucial in his academic success. It's crucial. So there are these other services that are important for students that have other needs. And I think we often toss them aside. They're the first to be cut. You know, we're focusing strictly on what's going on in the classroom without recognizing the influences surrounding the classroom and the importance of some of those programs as well.
So I get my takeaway on this is, are we measuring fairly? I don't think I would walk away from tests as a measure of something. But what I always come to is, it's not just the end product of the test. I want to know for students what they started out at. It's the gain over the course of the year.
Correct.
We will be back in just a few seconds with an ongoing discussion of charter schools and the impact of education in the state in the Think Tank on KTAR.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back in the Think Tank. Lisa Graham, former superintendent of public instruction, and journalist and blogger Julie Earfley. Well, Lisa, let me ask you. We've had public schools since Horace Mann. What problem are charter schools an attempt to fix?
Well, what they're solving is our inability to reinvent public education. They are doing that in a model that's based around quality. So one of the things, Mike, we talk about, what do they bring to the table? You can close them down if they don't work. And over the past 3 years, public charter schools have gone from, there's about 180,000 kids or so. We've gone from what we call tier one schools, or A and B grade schools.
Now, what makes you an A level school?
First of all, it's important. The conversation you just had, the way Arizona grades schools we use two things. We use your absolute score, and we use how far you've come, your gain. Where did you start and where did you end up? Individual student, year to year. So that is the algorithm for Arizona. It's quite progressive.
A September test, or do we have
test to test, spring to spring, match to match, student to student.
So in other words, we take kids at the end of 1 year.
Uh-huh.
In May, have a score for them, that's the baseline score that we track?
We run it against them the next year, right? How far did they go?
One question about that, and this has to do with who the school population. I have seen research on that, and the difference between lower-class kids and middle-class kids is that the lower-class kids deteriorate rapidly in the summer. The middle-class kids evidently are getting more stimulation and have a much less loss in the summer, which is attributable to who the group is rather than to any. The school, it's not a school effect because they're not in school for the summer.
It depends where they are, Mike. So first of all, it's really important, I think, to backtrack just a little bit. I think you should invite BASIS in here to give the actual numbers about BASIS and their attrition rates, because I don't believe that's as true. So you need to talk to them about who's actually leaving and who's actually going. One of the things I think is really important is, with all no disrespect to your son, Julia, I'm sure is brilliant, but that model is not around kids who are only gifted. We have extremely low expectations in Arizona. That's our biggest problem. You ask people who come from the East, who come to Arizona schools, whether there isn't at least a year's worth of difference in expectations. So one of the problems is BASIS is a highly performing school. It absolutely is, with no apologies. But it is not for kids with some sort of super brain. It's for kids with, you know, pretty normal abilities, but who want to make that kind of effort, et cetera, of course. But that they don't have this massive attrition that's attributed to them. And you have to talk to them about that. I think that's really, really important. And I think it's important in the public that we not just simply say that great schools are great because they've got great, wealthy kids who have these incredible privileges.
It's sure a whole lot easier to be great.
It's easier to be great, Mike. But there are 100 schools in Arizona that serve very low-income kids that are at the A level, pushing their kids to college. And I really encourage people to go look at them. This conversation is not about what's happening in Scottsdale and Paradise Valley and Peoria.
Because, you know, those schools are world-class level performing schools. I think that's true of American education in general. If you're at the upper 10%, we're actually doing great.
Right. Well, but Mike, we shouldn't be complacent at all. Our top 25% or our top 10%, which you just said, is the top 25% in the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So we have some of the dimmest bright bulbs in the world, all right? So we have to be really serious about that. We do not get as many kids into that top tier level, and we shouldn't be complacent. At the low income level, if you have 100 schools, public schools, with very low income kids that can serve at the A level, that's important to know. And we can't keep using poverty as an excuse. And you can't just say that what the governor's plan for wait lists is about basis and great hearts and wealthy areas. There are wait lists in Tucson Unified School Districts for the 6 low-income A schools there. There are wait lists for low-income charter schools on the border. The highest percentage of low-income A schools are close to Arizona's border.
Let me ask... As a researcher, this is what I always come to when I see talking about you set up a charter school and it's going to be better and you're in a low income area.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where we get the problem of non-equivalent control groups. Some, even within the lower education group, some parents are savvier, they're more motivated, whatever it is they got. Even when you control for education and income, if you have a school that people can get into voluntary by parental action, that is going to be a pool of kids who are destined to do better.
So you think that parents usually just don't care, that you want to put that on poor parents, that they're just not that active?
Or not that sophisticated. Absolutely.
Mike, if you know what these schools do to get parents in their school, you would not say that. As a researcher, I think you ought to go out in the summer with these schools and walk the neighborhoods they walk. Getting parents informed about the quality of their schools and what they have access to. Chicanos por la Causa today is just announcing a $200,000 grant to give parents information about what A through F means and what access to A means and whether or not they have it and the fact that they should use that. This is really, really important. If it's communities of trust, but we can't just keep blaming it on parents. Parents cannot outparent a bad math setting. They can't. If you spend a lot of time in low-income areas, which I do, because that's most of the work that we do, and you talk to parents about what they want these great things for their kids. What they didn't know was how their kids were doing until we started putting A through F on schools. That has generated a significant increase in quality. It's not true that we're not improving in Arizona. It's way too slow.
I have no problem. If Dad went to MIT and Mom went to Stanford, the parents are going to make good choices. I think most parents want good for their kids, but they take their kids, they deliver them to the local school, and they expect that there's going to be expertise. By the way, I think there's a fix to that. And the fix to that is if you set up a school and you get all these kids who want to go, at some level you do random assignment. If you do random assignment into 2 schools of an exact equivalent population, then you can measure the real impact that is exclusively due to that school and not due to self-selection.
Or if the student body stays the same and the leadership at the school changes and they go from C to B to A.
Absolutely.
So that's happening in South Phoenix. Yep. So you've got Golden Corridors
difference.
In South Phoenix, in Maryvale, in Nogales, in Tucson. It's really important not to suggest that because you're poor, you can't be operating at this really high level, or to give schools a pass when they're D and F quality schools and they have low-income kids. Well, there's a school a couple miles away that's operating with those same kids at A. So the fact that this exists in both district and charter schools and this level of quality is what we need to be focusing on. What is it that they do?
Well, I would have to agree with Lisa in the fact that I think it's about looking at the schools that are serving the same populations of students. When I was writing on this, and those numbers, by the way, were the numbers that BASIS reported to U.S. News and World Report. So that's where those numbers came from. And
It's when they start a school, they have small classes to begin with, right?
They have multiple classes of, for instance, fifth and sixth graders. And then by the time they get to high school, there is a huge...
But suggesting that the dropout rate is 25% over the duration, I think, is incorrect. But you would have to ask them.
Well, I have not given a figure. The only figure I gave was from the U.S. News and World Report, as far as they reported that they had 701 total students in 5th through 12th. And of that, 150 were in high school. And then they had the exact numbers in their high school. And they reported 20 students who had graduated from their graduating class. And I've seen that at the basis in Phoenix as well, that there is that massive drop off by the time they get to high school, which I believe actually is more about the fact that a lot of these students want the extracurriculars and some of the other things that come with the high school experience, which to a lot of students is also very important. And that they have then been given a good basis to move on to another school as well. But I think that's the point of the article, really, was that we're trying to compare apples to oranges.
Who's
instead
doing
of apples
that? I don't understand that argument. Any school can get to A, right?
I think it's harder for some schools to get to A.
Say it wasn't
harder. I think it's a lot harder. And I think in Arizona, what we constantly talk about is we're focused on just the A schools, and we forget to focus on the fact that we are starting with a lot of students who are coming in with massive struggles. We do have an issue with childhood poverty in this state.
Of course we do.
And so why aren't we ever talking about the money? Why aren't we talking about the fact that we fund at some of the lowest levels in the country? That is important. That is an important thing. And we walk away from it, and we blame parents. I mean, I hear people all the time who are saying, oh, it's the parents' fault. Oh, well, it's not going to matter. You can't just throw money at the problem. This isn't about throwing money at the problem. This is about finding out what it is that takes some of those students to get to that A.
Right.
When they come in with those additional challenges.
Well, we agree you should look for that.
Yes. And sometimes that takes more money.
Well, we'll talk about money. We'll talk about one of the surrogates for money, which is class size, which was mentioned here a minute ago, and other factors of educational quality. We'll be back in the Think Tank in just a minute.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Well, we're talking about education with Lisa Graham Keegan and Julie Earfley, and the subject of class size was raised. And I'm going to start it with a little personal anecdote because I think it's very revealing. My kid was in a district honors program. By the way that was described to me, they said, you know, in Arizona, the honors program, if you have a kid that's sort of average, but they're motivated and they do their homework and stuff like that, in Arizona, that gets you into the honors program. The district honors program is the stuff that a lot of other places would be honors. And I looked at the materials that they were dealing with. And I taught in four universities. They're doing college-level work.
Mm-hmm.
I had a conversation with one of the teachers who I really respected. I actually guest lectured in his class once in election season, which was kind of fun. Actually got better questions than teaching at ASU. But that was the level of that this was taught
in.
And I asked the question, talk to me about class size. You know, I think he had 25 or 30 students in there, something like that. And I said, could you handle more students in here? What would happen? And he thought about it for a second. He said, you know, in here I could. But there are classes with dysfunctional students where I couldn't handle 12, you know?
Yeah.
And so one size doesn't fit all. If you've got motivated students who behave, who are not bouncing off the walls, and are paying attention, you can probably handle a few more kids. If you have all kinds of dysfunction and problems going on, then class size is a real, real problem. I found that very, very. And I look at that, and I look at some of the countries that have done the most with educational performance, Finland being an example. They pour the most resources into the poorest schools. And we
seem
do we?
Absolutely. Title I dollars. Go to the Auditor General's report on what we spend on schools. Federal money, Title I money, money for poor kids. Absolutely, we spend more. I don't think enough of it gets into the classroom, but we dedicate a lot more money to low-income students.
But that's federal money. That is partial compensation for the fact that our schools are paid for, are they not, primarily by property taxes, and those are distributed
equally in Arizona since 1980. The state property tax is set by the state. Everybody, we sort of support at an equivalent level. Local districts can go to overrides and they can construct. But the basic
that's no small matter. Every school district just about goes to an override, and that's
They've had to, because they've had to backfill for what's not happening at the legislature.
There's no question that we ought to be spending more in Arizona. But I would ask the question, should we spend that on DNF schools that are failing kids? You lose ground in a DNF school. Mm-hmm. There's just no question. And grades aren't everything, but they serve as proxy for a lot of things, mm-hmm. one of which is culture. And Mike, student behavior has a lot to do with adult behavior in a school. I feel like we keep talking about schools as though they're just a function of the kids that walk in the door and not a function of the culture at the school. Mm. Schools dictate behavior. Schools dictate what happens to kids at a level that is much more influential than the family that they came from. And that's research. Mm. So all of those things matter. And yes, it's more difficult if kids don't have that background, if kids are behaviorally inept when they get to school. Yes, it matters. Our low-income A schools probably give the state about 6 weeks of free time. So the question I want to ask is, where are you going to put your money? Well, they're spending more time. They come earlier. They stay late. They do Saturday school. They summer school, Mike. Nobody's paying them for that.
More hours.
Yeah, more hours. They are not getting paid for that. Mm-hmm. So they're doing missionary work. I don't think that's the way it should be. By the same token, I don't think we should have these systems where one student, just simply because of the kind of school that they go to, is getting paid a lot more. The lowest revenue rates are for rural school districts that don't have bonds or overrides, because they don't have any additional assistance, which charter students have, and they don't have bonds and overrides that districts have in wealthier areas. So the inequities to this system are enormous. We've known it for a long time. I fought lawsuits about it when I was state school superintendent. We won those lawsuits and temporarily had sort of a fix. And now we've gone back during the recession. And now we're in a really difficult place. But the question is, moving forward, what are you going to do? Are you going to treat everybody as though they're offering exactly the same performance level? Are you going to try to set them apart somehow and teach from these fabulous schools, whether they are district or charter schools, and make our biggest investments in their time so that you can pay for more of their time?
But what about instead of getting schools that are already producing the A-level grades and focusing on those schools as far as adding more money to those schools without maybe knowing completely the input that they have in the first place? What about looking at some of these schools that are failing and asking them for a plan? What about looking at these schools that are failing and saying, okay, if you want additional funds, if you want to prove to us that you can bring that grade up, if you have a plan in place, then here are those additional funds.
And we do that.
So for instance, so like extending the school year, extending the school day, mm-hmm. When you're talking about funding, looking at how we fund students with disabilities, you get lots of additional funding if you have multiple disabilities. If you have one disability, you know, and you're doing an IEP, you'll probably get $10 as a school, even though you're putting in all of that extra work. So when you have schools that have multiple students that are on IEPs and they're getting an additional $10, you are turning that school into sort of this missionary work. And I think that that is an important part of looking at that school and the population they serve. So there's multiple influences coming into the school, and you're right, when there's already this inequality among districts based upon the wealth going in there, based upon the tax credits that you can get, mm-hmm. If you're in a wealthier district, if you can pass your bond and override, then you're looking at a situation where we've already set up schools in better neighborhoods to be successful, and we have yet another hurdle for these other schools to overcome in poorer neighborhoods.
So I guess the most important thing I would say is that the excellence is a decision. We offer school improvement grants in the millions of dollars, part of a federal program. You have to decide that you want to do what it takes to be exceptional as a school, as school leadership. And what I'm saying is, we have a lot of schools who have made that decision. They are not only growing their own schools in the district setting, we are going to have to learn how you replicate district schools in the same way that you do charter schools as a model, because that pattern of instruction is consistent and high. You have all of these excellent decisions being made, excellent work being done. And traditionally, we spend the bulk of our money, time, attention, looking at failing schools, trying to convince them to be at least mediocre.
Is that what you see the essence of? Is charter schools, your affection for this, primarily see it as a mechanism to introduce change into a system that is ossified? Is that really the essence of
what? I think that's the best thing that it's doing, Mike. It also introduces us to the people who do it. Excellent education is about teachers. You can start at number one and go to number 30, and you will still be at teachers. And now you start to talk about different things. The leaders in these schools are phenomenal. Whether it's basis schools or academies of math and science or Michikayo, which is a dual language program that started in Nogales, now is up in Tucson. And let me just add to that, though, Mike. C.E. Rose, which is a district school. Cesar Chavez, which is a district school in Roosevelt. The whole Glendale Union High School District, which is largely low income and all A. The number one AP school in the country sits in Arizona.
What are they doing different?
They are a cult, baby. They are phenomenal. their teachers are phenomenal. They work on data sets, on their instructional practice, and their interior focus, Mike. It's why you don't know much about them. They hire from within. They have been doing this for decades. I think they're one of the most interesting school districts in the country. They sit in Arizona. We rarely talk about them. And they're phenomenal. So we need like eight more Glendale Union High School districts because high school is our toughest road to hoe. So anyway, I would love to see them with the same kind of liberties that we give the public charter sector for replication, et cetera. And
but you're
I'd
saying
like
they're doing it without that latitude. If it's the public high school district.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. They are. Just like a lot of public charter schools that are getting to that same level without the same money that Glendale Union has. These things are critically important, money and people. Those are your two. I mean, you got to use those things really, really well. And in Arizona, we're going to have to deal with the fact that we spend as a public somewhere around $10,000 per kid. And in our classrooms, we're just not getting that down. And our teaching salaries are somewhere around $38
on
average.
On the subject of money, there's a lawsuit out there. There's $300 million that the court says are owed to the schools. If you were governor, would you settle up and pay?
I would try to settle it, and I think this governor will as well. And I would also look at things like the fact that we have way too many empty facilities, and you keep those open by operational appropriations every year that school districts have to pay to keep those schools open, but 25% full or completely empty, and they still have to keep that running. That comes out of teaching salaries.
Well,
I try to do away with that.
If you want to tick off a group of parents, just close the school in their neighborhood. Predictably, that will do it. Well, hopefully we have shed some light on a difficult and intractable problem. Charter schools, public schools, my hope would just be that we use the same yardstick to measure when we're trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. And thank you for spending this hour with us in the Think Tank. We've been here with Lisa Graham Keegan and Julie Earfley.